Part 6. Echoes of Eternity. Chapter 29. Siege of the Sanctum Imperialis. The Legio Kratos Titan, Serenity of Retribution, had achieved a kind of mongrel sentience, comprised of the instincts and emotions that generations of her princeps had experienced while plugged into her systems. She could feel, and to a lesser extent, think. She knew fear and pain. She knew the thrill and relief of victory. And above all, she knew how to hate. The crews and engines of Kratos were among the best at that. These were things her succession of princeps had known. So she knew them now. Her conception of these processes was crude, and she possessed no mastery over them. But she was a walking god of iron and firepower, so the subtleties of mental regulation were largely irrelevant to her anyway. She knew pride, too. This was the sensation that flowed fiercest through the electrical connections that formed her mind. In a lesser being, such self-obsession, with all her own achievements, might be considered vanity, but she had no way to assess such things. Everything Serenity knew and felt, she knew and felt with overwhelming force. She had lived through generations of commanding princeps, the calculation by which she measured time, and every enemy she had faced was either dead or had fled. In the boundaries of tumbling calculations that passed for her intelligence, she had every right to be vain. As she strode towards the Delphic battlement, she felt the exaltation of wondrous purpose. Her war horn blared in time with her Saurian cries, warning the vermin infantry at her feet to thank her for the honour of leading them. Final and ultimate victory lay beyond the wall. The immensity of her emotions allowed her a form of stunted imagination, and already she could conceive of the blessings her worshippers would sing up to her, as well as the fresh triumph banners they would hang from her guns. Her crew was dead, their corpses rolling around inside her head, lurching against their consoles and across the deck. Serenity of Retribution didn't know this, which was fortunate, because had she become aware of it, the revelation would have undone her in a way her emergent consciousness might not have survived. The path to sentience is a precarious one for all forms of life, and it was a journey often failed by even the strongest of machine spirits. The fact is, Serenity of Retribution was functioning on the legacies of what human instinct had imprinted on her, and whether that could fuse with the machine spirit to create true sentience is a matter even Arkan Land would have struggled to answer. He did, of course, have theories on the matter. She strode down the grand processional, destroying marble statuary beneath her, turning the icons of heroes into white rubble and clouds of powder, marching at full stride behind the thick layers of her overcharged void shields. She was one of the lead titans, her void shields offering sanctuary to many souls and tanks in her shadow. Incoming fire made her shields visible. They were layered curves of bruised light, fire spilling down their sides to fall upon the warriors below in napalm rain. The opening missile salvo from the Delphic battlement roared across the cancerous wasteland. Hundreds of warheads, thousands of them. And she knew, even with the instinctive awareness that could only arguably be called reasoning, that she was about to die. This proud warlord of the Godbreaker Legio had neither the honour of the first death nor the most catastrophic. Her demise was just another footnote in a list of names too long to ever be accurately preserved, not in the eternally unreliable mechanisms of imperial records, or by the word-of-mouth legend and chanted prayers that would pass for archival data in the future of the War Master's forces. She never knew exactly how many missiles struck her, and like so much of the war to date, the scale both defied easy calculation and meant nothing in the context of the woe it inflicted. They struck her like a warrior in a shield wall being struck by 30 spears in the same second. She was dead before she fell, Her void shields instantly burst, her superstructure igniting and blowing apart, scattering fiery shrapnel for a half kilometre in every direction. Her last thought was notable, however, in its instinctive unselfishness. It was a command, remarkable for the fact that no princeps lived to order it. Solace Sanctuary Protocol, she thought. The armoured cockpit that made up her head blew its lynchlocks exactly 2.7 seconds before the Sanctum's first salvo struck home. She willingly decapitated herself, the escape pod protocol blasting her head free from her shoulders along a hurriedly cogitated trajectory. It wasn't enough, and even had her crew still lived, it would never have been enough. The cockpit head clipped one of the incoming missiles, catching a flame and spinning off course in the wake of the explosion, before crashing into the wasteland. There it lay at rest, a blown-open tomb for the three souls that had died weeks ago, only to be destroyed by the curtain of artillery fire that followed mere seconds after the first missile wave. DeWine Koto hadn't needed to be conscripted. She'd signed up willingly. The Warmaster had liberated her world from the unfair demands of its alien overlords, and granted not only freedom but also membership within humanity's Imperium. When the recruiting ships visited a decade later, stating that Warmaster Horus had need of loyal soldiers to make war upon the corrupt Emperor, that had settled it. It would be a lie to say DeWine was entirely without guilt at leaving the harvest unfinished, but some things mattered more than storing up grain for the coming season. Her parents could hire on additional hands to see it done. DeWine, along with her older brother, had taken a wagon into the trading town and signed their names without hesitation. That was 5 years ago. Her brother was dead. Nessin hadn't even seen Terra. He'd been killed in a boarding action only months after recruitment, when their ship had been attacked by... well, by someone else, some other force loyal to the Emperor, some cyborged force of Martian horrors. Exact details rarely filtered down all the layers of military hierarchy to the grunts. At first, the lack of clarity on anything had frightened DeWine, but as time passed, she became inured to it. She came to realise that all she needed to know was where to go and who to shoot once she got there. Anything beyond that was a bonus. Acceptance of this fact was the first real sign of her veterancy. Corporal Primus Great Koto was in a chimera when she died. The first wave of firepower from the Delphic battlement was a missile fusillade focused on killing the Titans that towered over the Horde. But the second wave was traditional artillery, a rain of bombardment that blanketed the wasteland in fire and phosphex. In all her imaginings of her final moments, she died with a blessing for her family on her lips, or, when she really dared to dream, ended everything heroically, bleeding out on a mound of enemy dead. But war has no sympathy for man's personal melodramas. In reality, DeWine was instantly incinerated by a Griffon shell, striking her chimera, and what remained of her was indistinguishable from the mess of the nine other men and women, flash-fried to the shrapnel of their murdered vehicle. Deiphobos of the Emperor's Children covered the wasteland in great leaps, boosting in high arcs with thrusts of his jump pack, coming down in controlled descents to hit the ground running each time. He was one of hundreds, skyborne units from every legion, coming together in a boosted charge. He had changed since the war's commencement. There was something alive in his throat, something he felt shifting and curling, making his neck swell. Sometimes it made him speak with its voice and think its thoughts. He no longer wore a helmet, and his breastplate was a corroded mess, because he salivated all the time now, and his saliva was chemically similar to hydrochloric acid. Deiphobos had gone to the Third Legion's apothecaries long before the Terran campaign began, and demanded they remove the parasite. But it was no parasite, they told him. And as they showed him the scans, they chastised him for his lack of gratitude and vision. He was blessed. The refinement enhanced him, enhanced his lethality. And was he not a weapon, born and raised to exult in the taking of life? He had agreed, Or rather, the thing in his throat had spoken agreement, using his body to do it. Secretly, he had considered cutting it out, but he always remembered the scans. What he'd seen on those screens was part of him, a changing of his own flesh rather than some external intrusion. He doubted he would survive the process of self-removal. Soon enough, his alterations weren't even notable. Others in his own squad went through greater changes, never calling them mutations, always enhancements and refinements. He stroked his throat sometimes, feeling the way it swelled with his unspoken sins and secrets. Caressing it coaxed runnels of steaming acid that flowed sweetly over his teeth. Diphobos had long since come to terms with his refinements. He appreciated them. Not just the first, and not just their lethality, but the others that had followed, and the strange cocktail of desires they inspired. He wanted to taste Sanguinius's blood. That was why he was here, assaulting the Sanctum, instead of cavorting in the southern lands with so many of his legion brothers. He wanted to gulp it, to quaff it, so it washed over the changed flesh of his throat, stinging divinely as it went down. This need was eating away at him. It had been all he could think of for weeks. No other sustenance quenched his thirst, not even the Ninth Legion blood he'd drunk, not the Ninth Legion flesh he'd eaten. The need was making him spasm and tremble, so fierce had it become. An addiction to a taste he'd never tasted. He would not get his wish. He didn't even reach the Delphic battlement. Something approximately as hot as the sun and twice as bright hit his breastplate, dropping him out of the sky in a nauseating, disorientating tumble. His freefall lasted all of 4 dizzying, breathless seconds, and he died upon impact without ever realizing he'd taken a lascannon beam through the chest. Jehenu Kwa was a conscript of the Neshamir 8th Mechanized Infantry, riding in one of the 16 gunnery cupolas of an Orion pattern troop carrier. He stammered a constant stream of prayers and curses at all times of day, barely able to speak anymore because his throat was so hoarse. Each time he tried to sleep in the rare periods his regiment found the chance to rest, he saw the events of the last half year playing out again and again behind his eyes. It's possible to be driven from reason by sleep deprivation. Jehen had learned this the hard way. He was thrown from his turret when an explosion took out his transport, along with the hundreds of soldiers inside. He was unconscious for less than a minute, and when he woke on the ground, he no longer had the dubious protection of his squadmates and their armoured carrier. Jehen saw the wreckage that had been his platoon's mobile bunker for years, broken open and smoking, with bodies strewn liberally throughout. He was alone, armed with a pistol, in a wasteland of exploding earth, as gunships screamed in spiralling crash landings, and titans burned and shrieked above him, and the world shook, equal to any earthquake, and impossible dead things spanned the entire sky. He was crying out himself, though he wasn't aware of it, and not just because the sound was minimal with his abused vocal cords. Like thousands of others on both sides of the battle, he was deaf, his eardrums ruptured by the magnitude of the weapons firing above him, around him, at him. "Please let this end," he thought, which was the closest he'd come to thinking clearly in weeks. He ate the barrel of his pistol and pulled the trigger. His anima, what some would call a soul, unanchored from his body and went screaming through the veil between corporeality and unreality, plunging immediately into the boiling tides of the warp. The weakling soul light that had been Jehen Ukwa experienced one final sensation as it learned the lesson of what waited in death for all living things. And that lesson was pain. The pain of dissolution. The pain of one's soul light drawing demons the way blood draws sharks in dark water. Finally, mercifully, and in accordance with his dying wish, it ended. Varaxul had suffered for her weak genesis. Insofar as her kind held to any notions of physicality, she was a she, for the Neverborn are shaped by human deeds and fears. Like most of her kind, she was brought into being by an act of malice, in this case one of betrayal that led to bloodshed. She was also weak. Varaxul's genesis was in the guilty pleasure taken by a murderer in the back alley of a long-dead city in a long-forgotten empire on a planet that had died centuries ago in the gloom of old night. Like all her kind that lacked a ready source of faith or devotion to fuel them, she manifested in the warp and took forever to grow stronger. From her very first moments, her existence was one of parasitic cowardice, feeding on lesser secrets in the hearts of weak men and hiding from her own kind in case they abused and digested her for their own power. She had briefly served as a courtier in the halls of the willfully and ecstatically blind. This place, ruled over by an exiled keeper known as the Pale One, was an impoverished realm far from the grand court at the Palace of Pleasure. But even this far from the gaze of the perfect prince, ambition burned in the hearts of Slaanesh's children, and they made war upon one another with lies, poison, temptation, and a thousand other treacheries. Varaxul had fled the Pale One's entourage, wandering through the far reaches of the realms of chaos, distant enough to hide among the other scavengers, not quite removed enough to discorporate her. And then the summons had come. She'd felt the irresistible pull, the siren song of her young god's call. It wasn't merely a beckoning. It pulled at the very threads of her being. It dragged at her corpus, bringing her to terror whether she willed it or not. She had manifested weeks ago, clawing her way into the cold material realm, her mouth watering at the flavours of fear and the prayers for deliverance thick in the air. Since then, she had lapped at the brain flesh of skull-cracked captives, licking them with her barbed tongue. She had danced in battle with all the grace of her god-formed body, carving through the armour of humans and transhumans alike. She had moved with the clusters of her own kind, drinking the sensations of the humans around them, heightening their emotions and lying with promises of survival, and always, always moving inward. The names of the walls and districts meant nothing to her. She knew only that at the heart of all this iron and stone lay a castle, and within that castle was the flesh body of the creature that the Pantheon mockingly called the Anathema. But she couldn't reach the castle. None of them could. The desire to descend upon it throbbed inside the speculative energy that served as her skull. It pulsed with the malignant life of a tumour, but every step she took towards it met with an invisible field of resistance. This pressure rejected her. It repulsed all her kind, turning reality thick and worthless around them. It even hurled the Lord of the Red Sands back each time he flew at it in his rage. He was a disgusting and unnatural thing, a mortal elevated to immortality, and she wondered if this Angron and his Primarch brothers could even comprehend the disgust that the true Neverborn felt for them. When Varaxul and her siblings witnessed the transhumans seeking to follow their gene fathers into ascension, it had brought right new opportunities to promise them eternity and deceive them into doing the demon's will. But these were lesser concerns. She could prey on their desperate souls later. One of the recently exalted mortals, the one calling itself Magnus, was doing the will of the Changer deep in the labyrinthine dimension. Varaxul was nothing, unworthy of knowing the truths of the conflict, but she sensed the energies at play. She felt the weakening of the Emperor's efforts as the thing that was once his son wore away his strength. Blessedly, the Emperor's shield was collapsing faster, no longer day by day, but hour by hour. The threat of repulsion still slowly ate away at her corpus, but she and all of her kind were getting closer. Closer. When the Horde had charged, the mortal tide rushing towards the wall, Varaxul had been one of the many thousands of demons left behind. She watched the War Master's humans and transhumans race ahead. She watched them swarm the wall. And every time she felt the shield ebbing, she took a step forward. Princeps Ulien Gruna of the Warhound Hindara hunched in her throne, her posture mimicking the lope of her godmachine body. In front of her, Otesh was leaning hard into her controls, bringing Hindara around in a bone-rattling run. Himar was dead. They were both dead. She was locked in the cockpit with their corpses, was guiding the weapon's arm around to match their movement. "We've been engaged," said Himar, with his eyes on the Auspex screen. And though Himar said it, Ulien heard the words in her voice, felt them coming out of her mouth. "I'm talking to myself," she thought, "because Otesh and Himar have been dead for weeks."
"New heading achieved, my princeps," said Otesh.
They were running blind. The view through Hindara's eye windows was nothing but fire. Outside, the world was ending. Even with the cockpit insulated and shielded, the sound of the destruction was just short of agonizing. There was too much information to take in, overwhelming her senses, overloading her scanners. Ulien focused on a single flickering topography screen, doing what she could with the little data she could tolerate. The landscape before the Delphic battlement was a featureless plain of ruined earth. The hordes swarmed over it in their ragged millions. The closer they came to the wall, the more often brief bursts of the wider battle intruded. A stormbird spiraling down to crash on a rampart. Another titan going nova, near enough to rain body shrapnel against Hindara's long-suffering void shields. A swarm of Astartes, thousands upon thousands of them, charging along the rubble-strewn Grand Processional. Thousands more swarming the sheer face of the Delphic battlement, using entrenching tools and grapnels to climb. Most surreal of all was the slope of spent ammunition at the wall's base, an avalanche of ejected shells forming as they tumbled down from the battlement's guns in a never-ending clanking torrent.
10, Himar called back to her. 9.
Ulien forced Hindara forward, hunching into the storm of incoming fire. Her spotlight stabbed through the ashy air, illuminating the troop transports and battle tanks around her.
"The first gunships are on the ramparts," said Otesh,
watching through the interference plaguing Hindara's external pictofeeds.
"The first titans are almost at the wall."
Except they weren't the first gunships and the first titans. The first gunships and titans were smoking wreckage in the wasteland. Those making it to the wall were just the first to survive the atrocity of firepower unleashed upon the charging horde. Himar called again.
5. 4.
Ulien did her best to ignore the pounding against her shields and the shaking of the earth beneath her feet. Hindara had been repaired and rearmed once Ordax's maintenance vehicles had caught up with the front line days ago, but the reassuring weight of possessing both arms again was cold comfort when the world was ending around her. A sickening electrical crack told the tale of another void layer stripped away. Hindara gave a canine snarl in the back of Ulien's mind, as if blaming her for this headlong march into madness.
1,
said Himar.
0.
Hindara snarled at her again, a mind-sharing of revulsion, and Ulien's skin crawled in sympathy with her swimming vision. A snap of static cracked at her fingertips on the arm of her throne. Then it was over, and they were through.
"We're inside their voids," Himar confirmed. "We lost a layer of shielding from the abrasion."
She didn't need to give the order to relight the shields to full capacity. Himar was already on it.
"Stay back from the Delphic Arch. Let the sapping crews handle the portcullises. Find one of our reavers or warlords. Add our firepower to theirs."
"Aye, my princeps," said the two dead crew in unison.
Or perhaps she said it herself. It didn't really matter. She spared a glance for the army of disordered Astartes assaulting the wall, imagined the many thousands of defenders waiting at the top of its tiered ramparts, and focused on the task ahead of her. There was very little left of Cargos now. When he reached for memories, or even emotions, he kept finding anger, stripped of all circumstance. The realization that pieces of his mind were falling away should have been horrific, but the opposite was true. He felt purified, when he felt anything at all. Nothing cleanses the soul the way anger does. Nothing feeds righteousness like rage. He'd been inside a land raider. He remembered that. At least, he remembered the sensation of being trapped within it. The confines, the darkness, the sound above all else, the sound of the world being destroyed on the other side of the land raider's hull. It was a sound that broke the limits of sound, spreading to fill all five senses. He remembered the pride he felt because he was going in before the Neverborn. For some reason, that mattered. There was honour in it. In the beginning, it would just be the living against the living, human against human, legion against legion. He remembered what the preacher had said before the tank treads rolled.
The last gasp of mortal warfare.
Yes, that was it. And Inzar had sounded as if he relished the idea, like the sun was setting on something primitive and best left forgotten. Then the engine gunned. The land raider lurched forward. They were making for the Delphic wall, and things darkened to red and black. What else was there? He could remember... Wait, could he remember reaching the wall? Climbing it? Gaining the rampart? Could he remember those things? No, he couldn't. But he did recall... Wait, hadn't he come in on a gunship? One of the Thunderhawks that streaked in from the sky, a host of them aflame from the anti-air batteries. Yes, they hadn't been in a land raider at all. They'd come in by gunship. Hadn't they? He didn't know. These things were gone from him, taken by the nails. But he knew nothing, as he tears left and right with abandon, cutting, carving, killing. Kargos fights for his life. He fights for the amusement of the god of war, and he fights to follow his father down the path of blood-stained divinity. For to do anything else is to damn himself. There's no going back. There's only the path, step by step, one slaughtered life at a time. He doesn't think these things consciously. He doesn't treasure the truth of them. He knows them, that's all, and they've changed him. The truth of a broken existence squats at the back of his mind, and its tendrils flow through him with the flood of adrenaline and instinct. Zephon fought by Anzarael's side, surrounded by the last living members of the High Host. Their blades steamed as the power fields burned away, the blood clinging to the steel. This was far from how they'd waged war together in the glory days of the Great Crusade. Those were days of soaring on jump-pack thrusts, unleashing the destructiveness of retooled strife-age alchemicals. They were angels, in truth. Death from the skies, descending on wings of flame. Here they were grounded, going blade to blade, fist to fist. The enemy was without end.
"Forgive me for saying so, sir,"
Anzrael voxed at one point during the fighting.
"But this is far from a joyous reunion."
It started with the thunder of long-range guns. As the Horde charged, both sides vented an infinity of city-killing fire. Titans vomited missiles at the wall. Other Titans gunned down the incoming volleys and replied with their own incendiary rages. The wall shook beneath the defenders' feet as its gun emplacements poured firepower into the wasteland. It still shook. The Delphic battlement still fired, even on the second dawn, with the enemy at the defenders' throats, its few remaining guns blasting and their slaved auto-loading mechanisms clanking, making the entire rampart shudder endlessly. How many tens of thousands among the Horde were killed in the first charge to the rampart? How many Titans were torn apart by cannonade? How many gunships and dropships and troop carriers and transports were blasted out of the sky? The scale of it was madness, the numbers untrackable, meaningless. Even with an eidetic recall, Zephon could process almost none of it. It was just the prologue. All just a laughable prologue to the moment the Horde reached the wall. The attackers poured everything into the assault without heed or need of tactics. They came in suicidal packs of frenzied warriors descending on jump packs. They came in gunships and transports, carving furrows along the battlements and massacring defenders as they crash-landed in deployment. They blackened the sky with dropships and the towering figures of converted Titans. They came from the ground, climbing the Delphic wall with axes and blades, ascending over the mounds of their own dead or the piles of spent shells vomited forth from the battlements' ammunition ports. However they gained the ramparts, the defenders met them in a tide of red ceramite, locked shields and plunging blades. For Zephon, it began when a walking inferno that had once been a warlord titan reached the wall, towering over him like a blazing effigy. The titan, dying from its wounds and aflame from crown to clawed feet, was more a thing of flesh than sacred iron, and no longer moved as a titan moved. Ligaments and veins and muscles worked slickly around its iron skeleton. It gripped the wall with great hands of metal and bone and leaned forward, its flesh-metal jaw opening, disgorging a troop ramp like a bladed tongue, vomiting its cargo of world-eaters right onto the rampart. The thing was laughing as it did it, laughing from the speakers in its cheeks and throat, laughing even as it burned to death. Zephon, in the front rank, caught a world-eater's chain axe against the flat of his blade, and from that moment on, existence on the ramparts became an assault of sensation. Sight, sound, smell, all of it became a thing to endure instead of experience. A soldier could lose their mind in this, through sheer exposure to sensation. Thousands of the humans did. Another world-eater gained the wall half a second after he'd killed the first. Zephon beat the pommel of his blade against the warrior's faceplate once, twice, thrice. Ceramite dented, cracked, sharded. The world-eater roared his god-soaked noise, grabbing for Zephon's throat with one hand, thrusting a dagger in the other. The Blood Angel deflected the whirring blade with the edge of his greave, lanced his blade down in a two-handed grip that sank halfway to the hilt in the warrior's collarbone. He barely managed to drag it free before the world-eater fell, his hearts destroyed. And yet the defenders held to a ragged order. Imperial Army soldiers climbed onto the rear tiers of the rampart to launch grenades and stitch the air with lasgun beams over the heads of the warring Astartes, spearing into the enemy ranks. Where the line was breached, where the Blood Angels were beaten back or massacred in place, custodians led reserve forces to stem the tide. Word of Sanguinius spread across the Vox. Reports that he was on the south wall, repelling a sapper assault, or the west wall, leading a boarding action upon an Imperator Titan, or the north wall, rallying the broken defenders and retaking lost ground, or the east wall, where he was hunting enemy officers, lancing them from above as he swooped in low, soaring again after each confirmed kill. Who knew what was true? On the wall, every warrior was caged within their own war. Zephon only saw Sanguinius once after the battle began, a brief vision of his golden Primarch spiralling through the air high above their heads, hopelessly pursued by a pack of traitors in jump packs. He'd looped around, cutting three of them from the sky in as many seconds, then beat his wings to rise higher than the survivors could boost. Azrael went down, grappled by a cackling Emperor's Children legionary, while humans in scraps of armour stabbed at the joints of his warplate with energised knives. Zephon hacked him free and dragged him back up. Less than a minute later, Azrael returned the favour, killing a world-eater and pulling the fallen Zephon back to his feet. Sanguinius was gone, back to the realm of Vox reports that already took on the flavour of legend. Zephon fought on, his mind cold even as his flesh was wretched with heat. By now he would usually be frothing at the mouth within his helmet, exhaustion and bloodthirst combining to bring him to the very edge of his control. Yet he stayed cold and clear, enduring, hurting, fighting. Any battle is a succession of distinct conflicts, and the effect is magnified in sieges. 100 meters down the line, warriors might be waiting in phalanx readiness, still yet to bloody their blades, knowing they must not break ranks and leave their position undefended. 100 meters in the other direction, warriors are fighting for their lives, have been fighting for hours. Then the flow of war shifts. Reserve elements charge in to relieve exhausted defenders. Those that have been fighting for hours on end suddenly find themselves in a brief sphere of calm, able to retreat or brace for the next inevitable assault. Even in the shield-to-shield phalanx warfare of old Earth, men would wear themselves down to enervation within minutes. Those ancient battles that lasted hours were in truth divided into dozens of lesser skirmishes, broken up by entrenchment, advance, retreat, relief, recovery. It had to be this way. The human body was at the mercy of mortal musculature. War in the first age of trenches and gunpowder weapons was a horrendously long game of brief strikes and charges, broken up by days, months of waiting for the order to advance. The taking of a city still necessitated patrols, rides in armoured personnel carriers, returning to one's own lines for resupply, all transpiring over the course of weeks. The fighting was sporadic, not constant. But on the Delphic battlement, even the Astartes suffered. The press of bodies was all-consuming. Zephon saw nothing beyond the frenzy of overwhelming movement on all sides, at all angles. The threat of seizure was a constant in the muscles he had that were still flesh instead of Dark Age steel. The Kron, at the edge of his eye-lens display, counted time in stuttering leaps that went in both directions. Just another thing that had ceased making any sense. Thralls in legion robes and silver breastplates were everywhere within the defenders' lines. They hunched and crouched and scrambled between their Blood Angels' masters, some hauling away the dead, dragging corpses back out of the way for the sake of their lord's footing, others firing between the shoulders of the fighting legionaries, pouring lasfire into the faces of the War Master's human soldiers. It seemed every atom around him was visible, vibrating in peaceless motion. He heard everything. Everything. Thousands of sounds adding up to an oceanic roar, its elements indivisible. A blade against a blade was a clash. A bolt gun discharging was a rattling boom. But hundreds of thousands, all at once and over, became white noise without surcease. He smelled nothing but the burn reek of charred armour and firing processes, a stink so thick it threatened to replace air. Each breath in tasted of physoline. Each breath out tasted of the countless other chemicals used in the manufacture of annihilation. In the rare moments he saw anything past the warrior directly in front of him, it was always a momentary impression of titans dueling in front of the battlement. They went at one another with saw blades and fists and hammers and short-range volleys of fire that occluded them in smoke before Zephon could discern which side either one fought for, let alone who might be winning. And so it went. The engines of Legio Ignatum repelled every charge made against the portcullises sealing the Delphic archway. The ground of the wasteland was blended to ruination by the levels of firepower brought to bear, an expanse of hills and ravines through which the War Master's horde poured forward. Princeps Shiva Makul of Irokundos did what she could to thin the numbers of infantry and armour, but their orders from the Great Angel were clear. Ignatum was there to kill titans. The portcullis must stand. They fought unsupported by infantry, and that was a dangerous way for titans to wage war. It left them vulnerable, with several Ignatum god machines already standing motionless, boarded by the warriors of the Horde, their crews locked in fighting within the confines of their titans' engineered bones. Their principal advantage was the Delphic battlement behind them, and the keep atop it, with its shield-bursting gun batteries. Irokundos had scored its first kill against a charging reaver, an interfector brawler, stalk-striding ahead of its own maniple, either thirsting for glory or at the mercy of an unwise machine spirit. With its void shields extinguished, and its proud red and black heraldry bored through by Gatling fire, the interfector reaver was three-quarters dead already. Irokundos hadn't even needed to open fire at range. By the time the brawler was up close, sparks were raining from her abused arm joints, and she gushed oil and fluids from a dozen major wounds. The Ignatum Reaver strode forth to meet her opponent in front of the portcullis, stalking around to the rear where her plating was thinnest, and finishing her spinally with a volley of overcharged laser. But the hunting got harder as the hours rolled on. Shiva saw Gilgamesh crumble when it was half erased from existence by a volley of warp missiles. She saw Optima Dictat lose its brawl against another warlord, gutted by the miserable slowness of her rival's chain fist. Magna Excelsior was brought down by the dogs of Audax, dragged from her feet by a net of Ursus claws, and overrun by exoplanar Xenos, a description among the Mechanicus that was swiftly falling out of favour. Most crews were using Neverborn to describe the things now. A few even named them demons. Irrakundos held the line until her death, which came at the hands of the warbringer Glaive Maiden. Shiva didn't see it coming. Her Titan's demise was just one of the many that came at maximal range from coordinated fields of fire, when maniples would group up for a kill. The shell from Glaive Maiden's quake cannon struck 6.61 seconds after the final layer of Irrakundos's voids cracked out of existence, destroying the Reaver's head and a significant portion of its left shoulder superstructure. With the God Machine deprived of command crew, its stabilizers vented pressure, powered down, and went slack. The Titan's corpse toppled forward into the wasteland, where it settled with a crash and quietly burned, already half buried in a crater carved out by enemy artillery. Not that it would ever enter any Martian or Terran archive, but there was a lone survivor of this final fall. His name was Maestol Vuerir, and he was a deacon engine seer of middling rank within the Adeptus Mechanicus, as well as a lifelong servant and ally to the noble Legio Ignatum. He lived for almost another 2 hours, his legs crushed in the wreckage of Irrakundos's annihilated insides. There he remained, in excruciating pain, praying to a machine god he'd never failed, beseeching the Omnisire not to abandon him now. For the final 108 minutes of his life, between prayers, of course, Maestol tried in vain to move some of the debris off his legs, while it became harder and harder to breathe. He was unsure if he would expire from organ failure when his augmented heart and lungs gave out under the strain of maintaining his broken form, or fluid loss from the blood and reagent lubricants he was leaking from his shattered legs. Ultimately, it was neither. A chance spark from the Titan's failing electricals ignited a pool of spreading promethium, and he couldn't crawl away from the fire. It engulfed him, eating him along with the rest of Irrakundos's insides. He wasn't limited to a Skitaris's coded bleating and possessed a voice that was mostly human, so he could still scream. Which indeed he did. Arkan Land's new leg was killing him. Not literally, but a person should be forgiven for their moments of hyperbole, provided they were validated by context. And Land, in the middle of a war between demigods, while limping on a bionic leg that was poorly integrated and increasingly refusing to obey him, was feeling extremely validated by context. He'd also learned a lesson he would have preferred to go his entire life without learning, and that was the primal horror that runs through your guts when your own lines break. Land had come to realize that even more frightening than open battle was the moment a deadlock, slipping into a defeat, risked becoming a retreat. When a line holds, you can rely on the souls next to you, fighting as hard as you're fighting, and the soldiers behind you, ready to rush in and aid you when needed. Even in the worst of the chaos, there's a near unconscious comfort in these things. When a line breaks, you lose these tattered, precious reassurances. You can no longer rely on the men and women around you, if they're even alive at all. You're confronted with the fact that the enemy is stronger than you. You can lose. You can die. You will die if you hold your position and allow yourself to become surrounded. What do you do? Stand and die? Retreat and abandon the few survivors around you? Seeing you run, they run themselves, either out of the same prudence or the same cowardice, and the dissolution spreads. It's a train of consequences, each unfolding in inevitable succession, as more defenders desert the unravelling line. The War Master's forces broke through again and again, repelled at first by Blood Angel's reserves, then by custodian-led human units. How the Astartes in the front lines could even see what was happening was a mystery to Land. He focused on shooting between the warring Blood Angels, atomizing World Eaters and Death Guard, and who knew how many human soldiers in the colours of the War Master's regiments. When Zephon and the others stumbled on the mounds of bodies, he joined in with Eurystheus and the other thralls in dragging the corpses back for flamer teams to incinerate. Transactor 7Y1 had covered him without him needing to ask her. He was determined to take her with him, back to Mars, if they somehow survived. Many of the bodies they dragged turned out to still be alive. That had been quite the unpleasant series of revelations. It surprised him every time they started thrashing. Some were well on their way to dying, others were hideously mutilated in the manner most unfortunate souls tend to become if they were foolish or zealous enough to go into battle against the Legiones Astartes. They groaned and flailed and cried out for help as Land dragged them back from the front lines. Plenty of them still had enough fight left in them to stab at him or try to shoot him. These he dispatched with an atomic slug to the forehead, or he let the thralls' bayonets finish them off. A notable few were still aware enough of their surroundings to take heed of the incineration teams waiting at the battlement's rear, and these struggled or pleaded for mercy. Land dragged them to their burning deaths without even a proton's worth of guilt. Sweat coated him. He was swaddled in the stink of his own body heat, dragging and shooting and, yes, let's be honest, cowering and running for hours on end. Along with the other humans, he was exhausted long before the Astartes even showed the first signs of tiring. When the order rang out for the first reserves to march in, Land had fallen in place, dropping from exhaustion. Spit ran from his bloody lips in stalactite strings. His muscles shivered with an exhaustion too profound to codify. Unmoving, he let the reserves charge around him, and indeed over him, waiting for Transactor 7Y1 to help him up once their replacements had passed. Once he was back on his feet, they made their limping way back towards the rearward bunkers, set up as respite stations. Zephon's thralls were with him, also granted reprieve. The wounded, in their droves, were carried along the Royal Ascension, through the open Eternity Gate and into the Sanctum. Custodians and Sisters of Silence still guided scores of Imperial Army troops out from the Sanctum, ordering them to support sections of the embattled wall.
"We've been fighting forever," said Land.
His tone was one of exhausted wonder. The thralls nodded, their faces matching those of all the soldiers falling back around them, displaying a kind of grim awe that they were still alive. Transactor 7Y1, her facial expression obviously hidden by her helmet, pointed out that it had not been forever. She gave him the precise elapsing of time instead.
"It's close enough, T," Land sighed without rancour. "Close enough to forever."
Within the hour, they were back at the front line. Above all of this soared the Lord of the Red Sands. He beat flayed wings as he hurled himself again and again at the Sanctum Imperialis below. Each attempt saw him thrown back into the sky, while the gods' laughter at his failure echoed in his ears. Angron roared the words which would, in centuries to come, define his legion. He bellowed that oath across the sky, with only the scarcest conception of what he was saying. Words repeated in the shouted voices of every living world-eater. Words taken by the ignorant defenders as the ravings of berserks and killers.
"Blood for the blood god! Skulls for the skull throne!"
He was the strongest. Instinctively, he knew it was so, the way a beast hunting in its domain knows it stands at the apex of all surrounding life. But his strength was what held him back. The weaker Neverborn were beginning to advance, pressing through seams in the unseeable shield. The Lord of the Red Sands could see them, these lesser things, advancing behind the human horde. But the strongest of them were still repelled with hateful force. Hundreds of thousands of souls stood on the wall, fighting. He thirsted for their blood. He would wallow in it. He would pour fistfuls of their skulls down his throat. He would bathe in reaped life. If he could just breach the shield. If their father would just weaken enough.
No. Not if. Not if, brother. When?
Inzar's frenzy was a careful thing. He fought in the front lines, but he fought cold, forcing World Eaters and Death Guard in front of him to face the most eager blades, while he focused on butchering downed Blood Angels. Beneath him, the battlement shivered without end. It was still firing into the wasteland, bellowing at the advancing horde, bringing down titans and regiments and tanks not yet at the wall. Despite the overwhelming numbers the War Master's forces possessed, he suspected the taking of the Eternity Gate would be a protracted engagement, not the easy triumph many of his weaker-minded kindred were so earnestly howling about. He had to keep his wits and resist the lure of losing himself in the battle. Inzar hadn't come this far to die in the final days. This kind of war, this merciless kineticism of transhumans killing each other faster than the human eye could follow, was murder even on Astartes' physiology. Inzar was a field commander in his legion, and he knew his own limits as well as those of the Space Marine form. The prime virtue of the Astartes genetic template wasn't strength, but endurance. It was their capacity to endure that won wars, even against more numerous foes or technologically superior cultures. And it meant nothing here. Both sides fought with the same speed, the same ferocity, the very same capacity to endure. It was no longer an advantage for either side, just an evening of the odds. In the press of bodies, Inzar barely had room to move. He'd never been an artist with his Crozius mace, but all skill became fiction, a surreal memory of other battles. Like everyone else, he was reduced to grappling and stabbing at enemies close enough to hear the raggedness of their breath through helmet vocalizers. Warriors were strangling each other in the grinding front line, gutting one another with daggers for want of room to swing axes and swords. His primary and secondary hearts beat in twin flurries, forcing oxygenated blood towards overworked muscles. He was aware of them in his chest, in a way he'd never been before, crude, pumping organs that sustained him. His breath soared through the cage of his clenched teeth, and he heard the same bestial sound from every warrior nearby. These were the unwelcome sounds and sensations of mortality. His own death seemed a certainty. The only doubt was when the shell would strike or the blade would fall. The World Eaters wanted to fight. Of course they did. The Death Guard and Sons of Horus and Thousand Sons were almost as eager, if not quite so mindless about it. Even packs of Skyborn Night Lords were descending in shrieking covens, hurling themselves on Blood Angels' blades with idiotic abandon. It fell to Inzar and the other word-bearers stationed throughout the Horde's ranks to do what they could to let the humans run in first. Fools like Kargos, and what a useful fool Bloodspitter was turning out to be, wanted to wage this war the old way, legion against legion. But those days were done. This was all far, far too important for the indulgence of moronic conceits like legion pride. The humans in the War Master's ranks, hundreds of soldiers and cultists and conscripts for every Astartes on either side, were the most dangerous element in all of this. Individually, they were nothing. The Blood Angels killed and killed and killed them. The World Eaters even killed them in their mass-frenzied state, butchering them from behind if they found humans between them and the Blood Angels. They were faceless things, their uniforms and homeworlds irrelevant, a flood of souls without identity. The Blood Angels broke open their skulls and hammered them to the ground. Inzar saw the Sons of Sanguinius de-limbing them, disemboweling them, trampling them underfoot and crushing the life from them. But the flood of flesh never abated. Pulling one apart only conjured three more men and women jabbing at the Blood Angels with bayonets and shrieking at them in variances of Gothic that Inzar couldn't pass in the clamour. Their purpose wasn't to break through, of course. Their purpose was to die. These wretches scarcely dealt any casualties to the defenders, but they slowed them, wore them down. The very meat of the humans' bodies was a burden, clogging chainswords, weighing down limbs, breeding exhaustion in the loyalists by virtue of the amount of killing they were forced to perform. Inzar had grinned beneath his mask of office the first time he'd seen one of the Ninth Legion borne down beneath the thrashing weight of several soldiers, the humans dragging at the warrior's arms and chest, slowing the Blood Angel enough for Kargos to split the defender's head open with his axe. At first, the dead littered the ground, then carpeted it, then layered it. Attackers and defenders staggered as they fought, mulching the dead beneath their boots, the Astartes ankle-deep in cadaverous wreckage. Footing on the rampart grew treacherous with the thousands of deaths, blood sluicing across the stone in a conjoined gush. Warriors were sloshing through it. A glittering crust of spent shells floated on this sanguine sea. Ejected ammunition fell upon the mounds of bodies, decorating the dead with jewellery of smoking brassy cartridges. It was slaughter unmatched. It was glorious. Inzar felt like singing a prayer to the teeming sky. He looked up, where the aurora borealis, faces of his gods, leered down at the devastation. They were the truth, and what could be more beautiful than the truth? Was the perception and telling of the truth not regarded as the highest virtue? Was truth not the very thing, the fundamental thing, all souls strive for?
This is the way the world ends. Not with a whimper, but in fire. We have taken humanity's cradle and purified it, rendering it a beacon lit by the holy toil of the faithful.
Terror blazed in the endless night of space. The Pantheon had come as promised.
Soon, he promised his gods. Soon.